Welcome to this podcast of Inforum, a division of the Commonwealth Club of California, by and for people in their 20s and 30s, with a mission to inspire debate around civic issues. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at www.commonwealthclub.org/Inforum. You can also find Inforum on Facebook, MySpace, and LinkedIn.
Good evening. Welcome to tonight's meeting of Inforum, a division of the Commonwealth Club, by and for people in their 20s and 30s, with a mission to inspire debate on civic issues. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org/inforum. I'm Steve Jones, and tonight's moderator. Tonight we're here to discuss San Francisco bike policy with Inforum's program, San Francisco, the Wheel World. San Francisco is becoming a beacon for making the bicycle a viable transportation option. Yet, this is also a city that has been idled by a bike injunction for the last 3 years against any new bike projects, ironically for violating state environmental laws with its bike plan. And yet the number of cyclists on San Francisco streets has ballooned during that time. Why is that? We are encouraged to bike to work, but when will BART and Muni assist us with our commute by letting us take bikes on public transit vehicles? Should we be turning more parking spots into bike lanes? Yet at the same time, the bike advocacy exasperates some of those who walk and drive, giving bike nuts a bad name. What do aggressive cyclists and critical mass do to the cause of promoting cycling as a transportation option? These are all complicated issues, so let's get into it. Tonight, we host Tom Radulovich, who is the executive director of Livable City. He also serves as an elected member of the BART Transportation Board for the last 12 years. Andy Thornley is the program director for the San Francisco Bike Coalition. He is also a former chair of the San Francisco Board of Supervisors Advisory Committee for Bike Planning and Programs, and currently serves as chair of the Transportation and Land Use Coalition's Board of Directors. And joining us shortly will be Timothy Papandreou, who serves as the San Francisco Municipal Transportation Agency's Assistant Deputy Director for Transportation Planning and Development. An urban planner by training with a focus on transportation, Papandreou last worked for the City of Los Angeles. So let's go ahead and get into it. And I want to start with sort of a big day on the streets of San Francisco yesterday. We have these events called Sunday Streets. Tom, Andy, I know both of you were there. Why don't you give us a little sense of what the streets looked like yesterday and what the sort of face of modern bicycling looks like? Either of you.
Well, I'll just barge in on this. Sunday Streets, this is our second year in San Francisco of Sunday Streets happening in San Francisco. We ripped off a really great idea from elsewhere in the world, the ciclovia concept. Bogota, Colombia, famous for doing this for decades, other Latin American countries. Other North American countries doing this now. And the idea is that you chase cars off the street for a couple of hours. And in San Francisco, not enough hours, only 4 hours, I think, yesterday. Didn't seem very long. But in those 4 hours, taking a street and ridding it of car traffic makes it into a whole different place, a really beautiful place. And if you were there yesterday or at another one of the Sunday Streets events, you know it really is a beautiful thing. And yesterday was just beyond beautiful. Tom, what did you think?
I loved it. I live in the Mission District, and we have been, Livable City has been the organizer and the fiscal sponsor for Sunday Street since it started. And we started on the waterfront. The last two events have been the Mission District, our two biggest, and it was just wall-to-wall people. And it was kind of fascinating seeing streets like Valencia that I'm very familiar with, bereft of cars, and you realize how much space there is. These are enormous streets, and then the cars take up so much room, and it's hard to fill them, although we were filling them. 24th Street as well, you know, great shopping street in the neighborhood, just again wall-to-wall folks, cyclists, but also pedestrians and inline skaters and all kinds of folks. So it just really had the feel of a street fair. And the merchants have been loving this. They initially fought us last year in places like Fisherman's Wharf. This year they were lobbying for us to come back. So we worked in the Wharf, the Bayview, the Mission. Then next month we go to the west side of town, Great Highway, and Golden Gate Park. But every neighborhood we've gone to, you know, the merchants initially some trepidation, will we lose business? But then they're like, oh, please come back.
What is the sort of takeaway message for events like this? I mean, what are you trying to convince the larger San Francisco community of with these demonstration events?
Well, I think the first demonstration of this is, as Tom said, what else can you do with a city street? Streets for thousands of years did not have cars on them. It's really a fairly recent thing that we have cars on streets. So the first point is, hey, here's something else you can do with a street. What do you think? The second thing is, look at how much fun you can have without having to drive here, or maybe you drive to the edge of it. But in the United States in particular, I think a lot of people think of recreation beginning and ending with getting in a car and maybe has a car in the middle of it. And it turns out you can walk or bike or take BART or Muni or Caltrain, and you do not need a car to have a really full and wonderful day. And as Tom said also, look at how you can have a street that's thriving, not only with life of all ages, little children and grandmothers, but the economic life is very vibrant. You do not need cars driving right up to the front of a business for that business to thrive.
Yet here in San Francisco, we really love our cars. You know, this is something that it's taken as some kind of, you know, right to the streets. Tom, I mean, are we in an early learning curve compared to some other cities around the world with this notion of kind of multi-purposing our streets?
Yes and no. I mean, in a way, San Francisco was an early leader in the United States in reclaiming streets. There was a lot of great experiments here in the 1970s. If you've ever been to DeBose Triangle, that was one of the early experiments in traffic calming. I think in some ways now we're a laggard, and I think the energy that we're trying to create around things like, you know, parking day or Sunday streets, around all the organizing that's gone around the bike lane, is we want to catch up. As an early leader, well, first of all, a city who, you know, kind of conservative and sticky, so we did things like we held on to streetcars when a lot of other cities got rid of them. I mean, that same conservatism, though, is sometimes hard when you're trying to undo, say, traffic planning from the 1950s.
Well, and certainly a big reason why we're lagging behind is this bike injunction for the last 3 years. So, Andy, I thought you might kind of offer in a nutshell, why hasn't San Francisco been allowed to put in something as simple as a bike rack for 3 years?
Right, and I'm sure most of the folks sitting in this room, but for the sake of those listening at home or watching later, San Francisco since June of 2006 has been forbidden by a court injunction from implementing any physical changes for bicycle movement. No new bike lanes, no new bike racks, no new route signs. Really insane. So for over 2 years, the city has been forbidden. Why is that? Well, the city adopted a bike plan back in the spring of 2005, a master plan for bicycling. And before long, a couple of citizens, not groups of people, but really just a couple of people, sued the city and said, hey, city, you adopted that plan without adequate environmental review. It's the state law in California that you must undergo some sort of environmental review. So a Republican judge in the spring or summer of 2006, as his last act in office before retiring, said, I hereby enjoin this plan, and I forbid the city for implementing any of these things. The judge who took over the case, I suppose in a show of judicial solidarity and respect, when the case was finally decided, said, yes, the city does not have a bike plan, and I forbid the city from doing anything good for bikes on the streets, any physical improvements, until you readopt a plan and bring a plan forward. And I brought sight gags with me, so again, those listening will have to trust. I have a little book here with a few hundred pages of paper in it, which is The Bike Plan. And if you haven't seen The Bike Plan, this is what it looks like. I can pick it up easily with one hand. I have a giant pile, thousands of pages. I'm getting a hernia picking it up. This is the EIR, the comments and responses, and the CEQA findings. And a child could do the math. This little bit of paper caused this mountain of paper. This pile of paper cost over $1 million in several years.
And before you get to the happy ending of the story, I'm going to stop you there. And Tom, so this was all about a violation of the California Environmental Quality Act. Yeah. How is it that the state's premier environmental law could be used to hold up something as environmentally benign as biking?
Well, CEQA, California Environmental Quality Act, was you know, an early environmental piece of legislation, kind of sponsored the National Environmental Policy Act. So we were a leader. I think one of the reasons that things like this happen, the bike plan injunction, is CEQA now has some really perverse outcomes, especially around transportation. You know, it's still a great tool for saving endangered species and so on. But a lot of the transportation analysis you have to do, a lot of you know, the things that they say you have to mitigate the impacts of are actually things that are really good for the environment. So we have seen plan after plan not only the bike plan, but neighborhood plans, get sort of dumbed down. People really want to reclaim their streets, and then the CEQA really privileges movement of cars in the city. So what we see is all of those great street improvements get taken out. Great example, Hayes, the Market and Octavia plan recently passed, the making Hayes Street two-way, which is a, so some part of it was converted to a real one-way traffic sewer freeway feeder street. It's the main commercial street of the neighborhood. It was a real centerpiece of the plan. Let's make that street two-way, calm it again. It actually got taken out of the plan. So we had to go and advocate for the Planning Commission to do a finding of overriding significance, add it back.
And that, and that's simply because the CEQA basically privileges sort of existing systems and transportation systems. They don't want you to mess with what's called the level of service at an intersection, right?
Yeah, CEQA, again, to catch folks up, CEQA is a very good thing in the notion that it obliges everybody to talk about a project before you come forward with it. Before CEQA, which is sort of a child of NEPA, there's a federal version of this, but before CEQA, someone could come to your town, build an insecticide refinery next door, and it would open up, and you'd say, holy cats, where did that come from? Nobody told me about this, and we really should have talked about this first. So CEQA is all about, hey, before we go ahead and permit that freeway interchange or that insecticide refinery or that bike lane, we need to talk about it. And there's a very strictly defined ritual of how you talk about stuff. And if most of this is things, the stuff that would make sense to you. Clean air, clean water, noise, light, all the things you'd say, yeah, I want to know, is that project going to do those things? But there is an item on the checklist that has to do with transportation systems, transportation and traffic. And because for the last 35 years that CEQA has existed, transportation and traffic in this country and in this state means mostly car traffic and transportation, then the environment for car transportation and traffic is interested in being maintained. And so something like widening a sidewalk that's going to bring some sort of impact to that car transportation environment perversely is viewed as a significant impact. So CEQA is a great framework.
Why would facilitating auto travel be considered a negative environmental impact, Tom?
Well, one of the things that CEQA does is there's a bunch of assumptions, and you know there's a debate about whether this is intrinsic to CEQA or just the local interpretation of it. But there is an assumption that if you build a building, X number of people will drive to it, no matter what you do, no matter how much parking's in the building, no matter what that parking costs, no matter how good the transit is, no matter how good the cycling is. If you take away car lanes, people will still go and try and drive there, and so then they'll just sit in traffic. So, you know, none of this is actually borne out in reality, right? But there's this whole pseudoscience, I guess, of traffic engineering and planning that informs these CEQA documents. And so that's why you get these outcomes. And so maybe in a suburban place in California where the only way to get to someplace is a car, that sort of analysis makes sense. But in a city where you have a lot of modes of transportation, where you can walk, where you have choices, those decisions about, well, we're going to take away a lane of traffic here, or we're going to build this building with no parking, well, those things can work in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. So it could just be that the tools are misapplied.
Right.
It's valid somewhere else to say, all right, well, unless you widen the roads, you know, you're going to have congestion. Here, what we find is, you know, you take away a lane of road, and this happened when the Central Freeway was removed. All the traffic engineers predicted chaos and gridlock. Actually, the traffic kept moving, even though that freeway was gone.
So here we are. We're stuck in this injunction, doing this 2-foot tall stack of documents. And Andy, meanwhile, what's happening in the streets of San Francisco during that time? I mean, do people just stop bicycling because there's no new bike lanes and it's no place to lock the bikes?
What do you say, people? Did you stop biking the last couple of years? No way. Kept riding, and in fact, quite a dramatic thing. Since over the last few years, the Municipal Transportation Agency, the city's transportation department, go out every August, and they stand at about 30 or 35 intersections, and they count all the bike traffic that's going by. And in the 2 years since August 2006, bike traffic in San Francisco has gone up 43%. 43% more bikes went past those people in the county. And it's at the point now where the MTA estimates through other surveying that about 6% of all trips in the city are happening by bike. That's competitive with Portland, Oregon, and I don't want to get – that's a good competition, and I don't want to push on that. But even without any new bike lanes or, frankly, new bike racks, which is preposterous, bike traffic has gone up. So one way to read that is, oh, you hippies don't need bike lanes. You'll just keep biking even without that. Now, I would say rather that, boy, that's a great argument for coming back to the question of how do we privilege the streets. As Tom said, there's a sort of an assumption not only in the official planners, but even in the general public, that there will always be this many cars coming down the street. When the Spaniards came up on Sweeney Ridge and they looked down at the Bay Area, there were 10,000 cars moving up that street. That's always going to be true. Of course, that's baloney. And if you see how bike traffic has boosted even without rebalancing the way that we arrange the streets, it's obvious that it's insane to keep privileging the movement of cars. So I'll finish the punchline on this, Steve, and say that a couple of weeks ago, the MTA Board of Directors approved a new bike plan. We have a new EIR that's been certified. And in a month or so, once we get back through the court mischief, we've got to go back and ask the judge and say, hey, judge, look, we've adopted a plan. We've got a huge pile of EIR now. Take the handcuffs off. And he does. This city is just going to rocket like a slingshot.
We were still building tension to get to that point. Okay, but now you've opened that box. Okay, what did we exactly get? We got something like 45 new bike projects, right?
45 new, yeah. This EIR analyzed, this is meant to be a five-year master plan. So it's got projects that should keep the city busy for 5 years. But on behalf of the SF Bike Coalition, we will not be satisfied. We're going to burn through this in a year and a half. And so there were 60 projects analyzed, four of which are already in place. Actually, a fifth one is in place. And of that, 45 got the go-ahead from the MTA board, the Transportation Agency board. They said, go forth, do these things. There's nothing else to talk about. Crew, once the injunction is lifted, go out and start striping. So we got 45 bike lane projects, some of them huge, some of them very long, like Alameda Boulevard, the eastern bit, like Kirkham in the sunset. Other littler things that are still very important, like Market Street at Valencia. If you're heading west on Market, you need to turn on Valencia. What an awful intersection. There's a little fix that's going to make that much better.
But as much as this is the perhaps our biggest leap forward in new bike projects, you know, there are critics of the Bike Coalition who will point out these are still projects that were in the 1997 plan. These are projects that should have been done years ago. Why aren't we moving faster? Now, too bad Tim's not here. We could grill him on this, But why are we still so far back? Why aren't we kind of stepping into the 21st century?
Well, a part of it is we did get caught in this insane, perverse business of the injunction. And so in order to get the handcuffs off, this is like some bad video game from three generations ago. We had to go back and pick up the princess and come, you know, do this crazy kind of thing. And now we've picked up the princess, and I went, spun around three times, and that is going to let us go back to the judge, and he will take the handcuffs off. Now, we had to go back to the judge and reapprove a plan. And while this was all going on, the business of preparing the environmental document for this little thin object, and again, folks at home, imagine me holding about 3/4 of an inch of paper, in order to do the environmental review on that, was a huge bunch of work because of the stuff that Tom was talking about, these weird, outdated models for guessing what's going to happen with traffic now, 5 years, 25 years into the future. That was very time-consuming. And so to say, as some citizens did, when are you going to get to my street? This street wants a bike lane, and that's not on that list of 56 or 60. Well, the answer is, I'm sorry, we're trying to dig out from this swamp. But once that injunction is lifted, then I think you're going to see the city and all of the citizens coming back and attacking all those streets in a much more intelligent way. And we're not going to wait around and have a master plan. We're really going to get very aggressive about how clever we are. And this kind of comes back to Sunday streets and parking day and all of these other sorts of ways that you attack streets to make them healthier. I think this may be, if I could be so bold, the last master plan for bicycling that the city has, because we don't need a big battleship of a plan. We saw how that worked. From here on out, we're going to just go door-to-door guerrilla style, but we're going to be bringing along people who may never get on a bike, people who want a safer, quieter street, the skateboarders, the folks in wheelchairs. That's the movement that's coming now.
Well, and as soon as the bureaucrat gets here, we're going to drill down on him for why we're not moving quicker on this. But for now, we're going to drill down on Tom a little bit, because Tom's other hat is he's a BART board member. So we're getting all these new bike projects, still can't bring bikes on Muni, still can't bring bikes on BART. You know, why, you know, for those who are saying it's difficult to commute by bike, they need these links, why can't we have them?
Well, you can bring bikes on BART. Just there's an hour blackout during rush hour. And the concern there was about space. When I started on the BART board, I mean, not to sound like a politician, but I guess I am. But there was a three-hour blackout. We took it down to an hour. But we've been sort of, as we've been creating more space on BART, maybe you've seen where we're taking out more seats near the doors. The operations folks like that because it's standing room during rush hour. Bike folks like it, obviously, because it's a place that you can put a bike. So we had cars that were never really properly designed for them. We're creating that room. We've been chasing an increasing ridership, so I don't know where that'll end. Now, ridership's down, cycling's up, so maybe it'll work out. We'll have the interior modifications done, and we can have bikes on BART. So I think the transit agencies have been taking baby steps with it. And getting to Andy's point is, can you design a system that works really well for bikes but works for other people? I think there's a few things that I've seen happen at BART that are the really interesting pieces of infrastructure or design that tend to work for bikes but work for everyone. One's those accessible fare gates. We had these skinny fare gates that you had to kind of, if you had a bike, you had to take it in the side gate and go around and pay your ticket and all that. Now we have these wide fare gates, originally designed for folks in wheelchairs, but they're really handy for folks with bikes, with strollers, luggage, etc. So that's kind of a universal design solution that made it a bike-friendlier system but has also made it work for a lot of other people. Same thing with the elevators at our new extension stations, and we need to bring this to the city. We have these larger elevators, 6 feet by 8 feet. They have glass walls, so you can see into them. You feel safer. But again, great access for bikes started as access for people with disabilities. So that idea, that long, slow adaptation, I think, hopefully it'll pick up speed. But trying to reclaim streets and public spaces, and including transit stations. For all modes of transportation, that universal design idea that you can design spaces where it really work well for cyclists, but also work well for people in a wheelchair, or mom with a stroller. That's sort of where we're at, and making some progress. But yeah, it's going to be about another year, I think, before we've done all the cars.
Well, and I know that that the bike plan also mentions the taking bikes on Muni as a goal. What are you two as activists doing to push that, and when do you think we might actually see it?
Yeah, well, I will say there is a lot more in the bike plan than just the 56 bike network projects. And I'll put in a plug, on August 4, we'll have a treehouse talk at the Bike Coalition offices. So come to that, and we'll talk more. There are policies and actions having to do with access to Muni. Not only can you not bring a bike on a light rail vehicle, you can't even bring a folding bike on an empty bus. That should be struck down instantly. There's no reason why you should be discriminated against with a folding bike any more than somebody with a laundry hamper or something like that. So there is, in the bike plan, the city says we shall have a trial of bringing bikes onto light rail vehicles. There are definitely geometry issues, the breed of cars, if you ever get on one of those N-Judas, it's kind of hard even as a pedestrian to get in and out of one of those. But if you've got a bike and you have to pay the fare, so there are definitely some hinky things to that. But the city has definitely, and if Tim were here, he would give you his hedge on this. Once the injunction lifts, it's going to be like just a fireball. The MTA is just going to become hugely productive, and all of this stuff is going to start to happen. I want to note on this notion of transit interoperability, Caltrain, and an interesting thing that's happening there, and I think it reveals a little bit about changing perspectives. Those of you who know and use Caltrain with or without a bike know that for about 15 years you've been able to bring a bike on board Caltrain as long as there's room. And Caltrain trains have had progressively more and more space to bring a bike on board. But if you're the 16th or 17th person and it's a 16-hole train, you get left behind. That's what's called bumping. And there has been a misapprehension of the valuation of the regional trip. Pow, there's a big policy phrase for you. We have not calculated properly the value and cost of moving a human body from San Mateo to Berkeley. In BART's case and in Caltrain's case, initially the stations were built up with big oceans of parking lot around them for cars because that's how people get to stations to make regional trips. You drive, or your wife or husband drives you, drops you off, and then you get a cab or drive from the other end. Folks, meantime, were biking to and from Caltrain, and man, that's a much more efficient way to go, except that the people who were showing up with a bike and bringing it along were being viewed as someone who's getting an extra privilege. We're taking a seat. You're getting something extra. And the bicyclist was sort of tolerated as someone who was getting something extra. But the more that we do the math, the more that we see that the subsidies that come to the parking lots, the subsidies that are given to the transit systems that feed are adding to the cost of that regional trip. And that poor schmo who brings his bike, takes it on board, and rides away at the other end is actually putting the least burden on that whole system, not only for the subsidy, but for the other issues of climate, regional congestion, roadway congestion, all those transit systems that would rather sell that seat to someone else. Mm-hmm. So I've given you a kind of a long pitch on the Caltrain model, which SFBC and others have been advocating and pushing on. We're trying to get people to realize the value of that trip. Actually, that bicyclist who's bringing his bike along isn't getting something extra. He's doing everyone a favor.
So clearly, if you two were in charge of the city, we'd have a very different looking city. But there's a lot of people that don't want you to be in charge of the city. there's certainly a backlash against the bike movement in the city that's strong, has strong visceral reaction. So I was wondering what role do events like Critical Mass, Aggressive Bicyclists, the sort of radical edge of bicycling, what do they do to the cause of winning some of these goals that you're talking about? Tom?
Tom, yeah, I prefer Tom to answer that question.
What do they do? Well, you know, on the one hand, you know, as somebody, like, I'm in a suit today, and so a lot of people don't think I'm a cyclist when I go out dressed like this, because I guess you're supposed to wear reflective outfits. So so you get a lot of this, well, these cyclists out on BART, they do this, they do that. So there's a lot of you people, which is fascinating to me. And I said, well, you know, so you're a driver. Well, you know, people drive crazy, but you never say, oh, you drivers, right?
You're part of the driving community.
Yeah, so the driving community, why don't you, you know, obey stop signs? You know, why do you kill people? People. You know, why do you do this? Why do you do that? So the you people about cyclists is kind of fascinating to me, you know, because when they don't think that you're one of those people, then, you know, they'll kind of unload to you about cyclists. And I'm like, well, I bicycle. And then there's always a little bit of backpedaling. Well, you're not like those other ones. So, you know, some part of it does feel unfair. And some part of it is fair. You know, we need to, as a society, you know, and we hear this all the time about European cities. Well, people cycle slower, they'll pause for pedestrians, et cetera. Americans are in a big hurry. So some part of it, I think, is just that we're Americans. You put an American on a bike, he'll behave differently, just like you put an American behind the wheel of a car, he'll behave differently. Some part of it is we need to just kind of have better street designs. One of the reasons, I think, for all the conflicts, you know, we always talk about stop signs. The city loves stop signs because they're cheap. Other cities are doing roundabouts. Stop signs, as you know, if you're a cyclist, especially kind of an older, lazy cyclist like myself, well, you know, you're under your own power, so you've got to, like, actually slow down, stop. So you kind of want to run those things. But roundabout solves that problem elegantly, slows down the traffic, but you don't have to stop necessarily as you go into it. So some of it's design. Some of it's
but
the
there
culture.
Is certainly, I mean,
yeah, it, and there's certainly those people who are crazy.
That there is right. A radical edge of the bike movement.
Absolutely.
Annie, you get that. Why can't the Bike Coalition control critical mass, for God's sake?
Oh, man. Yeah, that's an excellent question. When will the SF Bike Coalition disavow critical mass? And I would say at this point, with 10,000 members and more, there's a growing portion of our own membership who ask that question. And as Tom says, it's fascinating. Mm-hmm. Which is a way of saying, oh, man, I wish I didn't have to deal with this. But I would say also, as a man of a certain age who likes to ride slowly and stop and talk, and I'm not in a big hurry anywhere, I'm not one of the 20-year-old boys who is making critical mass a problem. I would say to what I usually tell people, which is critical mass for me isn't that interesting anymore. Let's talk about parking day. Mm-hmm. If you want to go apply your energy to something that takes the streets and turns them upside down and captures a lot of the original essence of critical mass, let's talk about parking day. And if you don't know about it, go Google it. It's coming up in September.
So then you just try to change the subject.
Try to change the subject. Because I would say that, you know, critical mass, if it ever had a point, it never really had a point. Right. If you think that critical mass is a protest, you've missed the point. If you think that it's a demonstration, it is only to the extent that it demonstrates here is what a street looks like when it's filled with people on bicycles. It's a science fair demonstration more than a political demonstration. But it's a big party and it's a celebration. But to the extent that critical mass was a statement that, hey, everybody, wake up. There are people on bikes and we deserve attention and we deserve respect, it has been very successful. To the extent that it's become very predictable that at the last Friday of the month, a lot of folks will show up and roll around and just have a big party, it's lost much of that point making because it really has fallen when it goes wrong. And mostly it goes well. And I think critical mass is still fun and good. But when it goes wrong, it's very easy for people to vilify it as just a bunch of righteous punks who are disobeying the law.
So then that's the big public statement. But there's also those daily tactics by bicyclists that tend to bother a lot of drivers. Mm-hmm. The fact that that a lot of us don't stop fully at stop signs, mm-hmm. we'll go through stoplights. Tom, I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the sort of logic behind having the laws the same for bikes and cars, and whether there's any prospects of having two different standards and the wisdom of that.
Well, just my critical mass story was when we were trying to tear down the Central Freeway, a group of people organizing against it decided they wanted to do car critical mass, they called it. And so they did this big demonstration. They all drove to one place. And, of course, you had a traffic jam. Nobody noticed that it was a protest because that happens every day in San Francisco. So it's so invisible to us. You see a mass of cyclists, well, that's something odd and peculiar. You see a mass of motorists, you're like, oh, it's normal.
Critical mass for cars is known as rush hour, right?
Exactly, yeah. So known as rush hour. It happens twice a day. So so on the subject of, street designs, you know, one of the things we're really interested in is should there be one, two, or three different designs for streets? I think, you know, as we look at bike infrastructure in the city, there's a lot of emphasis on lanes. You know, we're interested in this idea of shared space. So where traffic volumes are low, speed's low, well, can you design the streets so all of the modes of transportation can share? It usually makes, at least in this city, makes transportation planners really nervous, although it's working extraordinarily well. In other places. It's traffic calming, home zones, has a bunch of names. So that's one idea is, you don't need to necessarily segregate cyclists, motorists, pedestrians. You need to just slow everybody down, get people to pay attention. That's a street design that might work. We want to test that. On the other end of that, of course, we might want segregated bike lanes. These Copenhagen style, they're called bike lanes, which are completely segregated from the traffic. One of the places is the Embarcadero. We always get these complaints about folks cycling on the sidewalk, which you're allowed to do. It's not actually a sidewalk. But it's a good illustration of if you really want to design a city where people from, I'm going to steal Andy's line, as I always do, people 8 to 80 feel comfortable cycling, you've really got to think
Gil about that. That's
Gil Penulosa.
Yeah.
Right. I stole it from
when
you.
I left,
you
stole it from me.
You know, if you really want to create a city where people from ages 8 to 80 feel comfortable cycling under their own power at all times and all places, well, you got to really get a bigger toolbox than we have here in this city in terms of street design.
You're bringing Gil Penulosa, Enrique Penulosa from Bogota, Colombia. They were kind of innovators in this, and they make the point strongly that bikes shouldn't be on the streets. You'll never get people 8 to 80 on the streets. Is that a realistic goal for San Francisco?
Yeah, no, it's an excellent question, I think, to rephrase that. And we hear this, again, from our own members, and even me sometimes. I hear myself say, you know, if we are going to get to the point where it's more than just the 25-year-old boys and the kamikaze cyclists, as Gil Penulosa says, if we're going to get to having children and mothers and families, we can't keep expecting people to get out in the middle of Market Street and say, oh, there's a Shero. That means you get to ride there. Well, you know, grandma doesn't want to ride on the Shero. We really do have to make a commitment to reshaping the streets physically. We really do have to give space to cyclists. And I think part of that is, I would say as a North American, U.S. citizen bike advocate, it won't look like Denmark completely. It's likely to be more about getting the cars off more and more. And that is Danish, I will say. We understand that in Copenhagen every year for the last many decades, they've removed a few percent of surface parking, and by taking away the parking, you start to take away the cars.
How much do you want?
That's a whole other conversation.
How many San Francisco parking spots do you want?
Well, I think you want to get down to the point where every street, or almost every street, has so few cars that a couple of friends could be playing touch football and yell, car! Like you did when you were 7 years old. You remember that? Who lived in that kind of neighborhood? That's my standard. Mm-hmm. I want Second Street to be at the point where I can be out playing football. And we saw this yesterday on Valencia Street. Even after the Sunday streets ended for the day at about 2:30, a quarter of 3, I saw people standing in the middle of Valencia Street throwing a frisbee. And they were saying car as a car came by. Mm-hmm. And and perhaps some of those people are in this room. Mm-hmm. So we achieved that on Valencia Street yesterday, that sort of not shaping the built environment as much as removing the danger. Part of what CEQA hasn't captured well in analyzing environmental effect is not only air pollution, water pollution, we capture that very well, but there's danger pollution. Mm-hmm. Every car trip on a city street introduces a little quantum of danger pollution. And that danger pollution builds up. You have 100 cars coming down the street. You can measure the danger that you've introduced for pedestrians and cyclists and everybody. What we really need to do is turn down the danger pollution from the cars. So, yeah, how realistic
is
that?
How do you win political consensus for that in a city like San Francisco, where the argument you always get is, but I need to drive. I've got young kids in school. I've got to do this. I've got to do that. You know, you're going to make it difficult for people to get to their jobs. I mean, how do you win that political argument here, Tom?
Well, you know, I think we have a lot of successes to show. I mean, we've had since the 1980s a policy which says we're not going to build a lot of office parking in their downtown. 70% of people who work downtown now take transit, which is extraordinary on a global scale. So, you know, we have improved transit in the region. We've improved transit in the city. You know, we talk to merchants all the time. Oh, well, you know, they say everyone needs to drive here. Everyone drives here. There's a study. It's going to be read at the Board of Soups tomorrow. It shows, well, when they did surveys of how shoppers got to neighborhood commercial districts, they found in the four that they studied, 70% of people walked, cycled, or took transit. So there's a lot of misapprehensions about everyone has to drive or everyone does drive. So those of us who don't, those of us who walk and cycle and take transit in the city, we're kind of invisible. You know, the city's not designed for us, and there's kind of this notion of the privileged driver that you're designing the city for. But that's, you know, that's not all of us. And it's in some places, it's not even the majority of us.
But
that's a problem. But to answer your question, mm-hmm. Steve, and you raised a great point, which is that sort of paradox of people who, you know, as cycling advocates, which we all are, we're saying on the one hand, well, we're vehicles, you know, we're allowed full use of lane per California vehicle code, you know, you have to let us merge, you have to treat us like a vehicle. Problem is when you've got too many other automobiles that you're sharing the road with and they're driving at too high a speed, well, it just doesn't work. And, you know, they can bully you, they can push you over to the side, they won't see you, you know, so you're in danger. So there is that paradox of, yes, we want to be treated like vehicles sometimes, but we want segregated facilities when there's too many vehicles that it is unsafe for us. So, and I think that's a hard message,
right.
Because, and that's maybe why drivers are kind of angry is, well, what do you want? You know, do you want to be in the street? Do you want to be, well, where do you want to be? Hmm. And the answer is it depends on the type of street. And again, we would like streets that feel safer for all.
Are streets safer when you have more bikes on the road?
This is what research has found. Mm-hmm. In fact, I understand Peter Jacobson, one of the key researchers for that concept, is coming to town pretty soon, maybe even in a week or two. This notion that on a given street, if there's one cyclist riding up that street, that cyclist safety is pretty poor. If there are 10, it's much better if there are 100. This is really what critical mass is about. This is how critical mass started 17 years ago. Two people riding home at night said, I don't feel comfortable. How about a few other four guys come with me? And you get to the point where, oh, this is great. I'm much more comfortable because there are 10 of us riding in the street now. And it isn't about taking over or being a bully. It's really about being visible, having motorists know to expect you. So adding cyclists is the best thing we can do for safety, and whether that's with bike lanes, better enforcement, encouragement, all those things, whatever gets you more people riding on the street. That's
so now we've had Tim Papandreou join us, so it's about time to drill down the bureaucrat. What's taken so
What's
long to get
Muni?
Decent bike projects in this city? Come on.
Well, if it's anything like United that was canceled, then delayed, I really thought I could use high-speed rail to get here today. But
why is it so complicated to get something as simple as a bike project, though?
I think it's just... I wasn't prepared to answer that question right now. So we've done a great bike plan. I don't think it's the question you asked was why is it so difficult to get something so simple like a bicycle lane put in? Mm-hmm. And I think what's really the crux of
I'll ask the questions here. Come on.
Yeah.
I think why is it so complicated? Just paint on a street.
Because you're changing the way that you use the road, and the way that the road's been used for so long has incrementally been eked out for certain users of the system. And when we're trying to develop a system for everybody, and then we change our mind and say, no, we actually have to accommodate more users, and then we have a policy that says, actually, that's what you should be doing in the first place, all of a sudden now we're looking at the road space and saying to ourselves, what's the best use of this road space? Mm-hmm. And how much should we dedicate for each user of the road space on the facility? And there are times where we say where the bike lanes, for all their good intentions, are literally the, you know, what breaks the camel's back. It's like that's the deciding point now, because we really want to put in this facility, but is it at the expense of parking, actual travel lane, or does it affect transit service? And that's what we've been really having to deal with
this whole
time.
We've officially been a transit-first city, as a matter of record, for about 30 years, right? It seems like only about now are we kind of putting meat behind that. Is that a fair assessment?
I think it's an evolution. Mm-hmm. If we've been evolving towards that. I think that the policy that the people that put the policy in place all that long time ago, I'm not sure that they had envisioned us being getting to the fights at the mat over physically a few feet or a few inches here and there, and then having an Environmental Quality Act that is supposed to be protecting the environment, and that gets to this point where we can get sued and delay for years and years. So I'm not sure that was the intention of the Transit First policy. The Transit First policy was to create basically a complete network so that everybody can get around without a car. That's the ultimate goal, whether it's walking, biking, or transit.
Tom's nodding. So what was your interpretation of the reason and what was meant by this transit first policy? Why do it, and what was it intended to do?
Well, actually, it went in 1973, and it was said we're a transit first city, and go create a complete transit network on the roads. Take the road space that you need to move transit vehicles effectively through the city, and go take it. Which was an interesting instruction from the Board of Supervisors. They said do it in 6 months.
In 1973.
In 1973. Here we are, 35 years later, still trying to figure this out. But it actually was directly to Timothy's point. It was about we know that actually it's about how you allocate space on the roads. It was about what modes do you prioritize and winners and losers, which is a hard thing in politics, right? Yeah. I mean, any political player, a planner, a politician, if you want to try and please everybody. But the thing is, sometimes you can't please everybody. You've got to make tough choices. And as a city, we've had good policies. We've sometimes made tough choices. In other places, we haven't. We've kicked the can down the road. And I think, like I said, bike plan in some ways picked the scab off, as it were, in terms of a lot of fights about neighborhood traffic, about neighborhood parking, about, Muni doesn't work. I need my car, all this comes up anytime you kind of raise these questions. Right. So it's not easy, but the direction was clear back then, and we've spent a lot of time trying to figure it out.
So, Tim, what do you think are going to be, looking forward, what are some of the most effective policies that the MTA is working on that are going to increase this mode share, as they call it, get more people using transit, using their bikes than we have now?
I think the one thing that we're talking about a lot, we don't have it physically in stone yet, but it's the mode shifting. It's really shifting from the existing modes to more sustainable modes. And obviously, bicycling is the most sustainable form of transportation.
Can you say that again?
Bicycling is the most sustainable form of transportation. Per calorie, per mile, it's actually more sustainable than walking. So you expend less energy moving on a bicycle than you do on your feet.
So I can get twice as far on a single burrito on my bicycle.
Totally. Absolutely.
As I can walk.
It depends if it's got cheese in it or not.
Right, it's something like only about 1% of federal transportation funds go toward bike projects, or even less than that.
Less.
If that's true, that bikes are the most effective modes of transportation,
sustainable.
Most sustainable, most effective as far as...
Well, every mode has their limit in reach. For example, transit can get you to a certain point. Transit's really good at moving a lot of people in specific directions. Bicycling is really good to get people around where they want to get to if they can ride a bicycle and if they can get on a traditional bicycle. Okay. That's the big if. So a lot of people look at the traditional bicycles there and say, I can't ride that, I'm either too frail or too young or too inexperienced or too scared, et cetera, et cetera. And so we have to basically evolve the 19th century technology with 21st century infrastructure and then look at the bicycle itself like they have in Europe, where bicycles are no longer just two-wheeled contraptions. They have three wheels, four wheels, they have a bucket at the front, at the back. People haul cargo in other parts of the world. They use the bicycle system, but it's not really just the traditional, mongoose or hybrid or whatever it is. So the bicycle itself is very sustainable. The application of the bicycle has got a lot of barriers and impediments in the United States.
What percentage of the population do you think is realistic for us to get on bikes? I mean,
are realistically get on bikes? Yeah. Well, if it's anything, I mean, if we're human beings, just like other human beings are in the world, so I think realistically for the city of this size, 20% mode split shouldn't be unrealistic as the ultimate goal. Maybe 30%. Once you get to 50%, then we've got to find out what's going on.
Danish people can't do that.
For context for the readers at home, I think, or the viewers at home, I think about 5% is the most we have in this country. Only European cities get to 20%.
We climb six.
We claimed 6 in our recent survey, trying to get the TA to agree to that. But but yeah, I mean, it's just what do we use it for and how do we get around? And so I think that's where we need to evolve. For example, bike sharing has been very successful in the world. Electric bicycles or what they call pedal assist bicycles for the rest of the demographic that isn't able to cycle up and down those hills. And, you know, we only have one wiggle, and if we can have more of those to get around the city, then that would really help. But it's just that the bicycling itself is the most sustainable form of getting around. Now, if we had air-powered tricycle vehicles, I mean, that'd be great too.
Well, and the city's going to be doing a bike sharing program similar to Paris, but the one difference here is we're talking about like 50 bikes. Is that
no?
Really
they're talking about a demonstration right now as a pilot demonstration, just to see. You know, there's about 4 different systems around the world right now that are fairly unique. And there's been a lot of problems with all of them. And so the direction that we'd like to go in is let's test these out. Let's just test 1 or 2 of them out. It won't be a test and then we cancel it. Let's test that out and then build upon that and do the large-scale bike sharing program that
but is But is 50 bikes really a test? I mean, that's a small rental shop.
It's a start. I mean, yeah, if we can make it bigger, let's do it. But right. I think right now we're just looking at, we have potential partnership. We've heard interest from City Car Share because they want to expand their role as a mobility provider. So if we could expand with them, then that's going to be a great opportunity for us as well.
Steve, I'd like to come back and answer the question you put to Tim as a provocation to Tim and to Tom on what, you know, MTA policies that are going to be effective at changing mode share.
I didn't finish the question.
Well, I mean, I'm going to set you back up with this, and that is appropriate pricing of automobility.
Yes.
Appropriate pricing of automobility in parking, in access to roads, right. and so what's MTA doing with that?
So we're starting off with SF Park. We're experimenting with keeping the, if anybody knows Don Shoup and all his work on parking policy, he was my professor, so we're Shoupistas. So we're really pushing that 85% maximum and minimum occupancy of the parking commodity, because it actually is it's a resource.
There's enough parking in San Francisco if you price it right.
Well, I want to interrupt you for 1 second. I just want to say that we're going to be starting questions in a few minutes. So if you have questions in the audience, start to work your way up to the mics. Right. We'll be taking those in just a few minutes. I'm sorry.
So SF Park is one, just real quick. SF Park, obviously the bike plan, the transit effectiveness project to really beef up the robustness of the transit system, because it's sorely over capacity in certain areas, is not performing very well. And then the fourth area is, you know, obviously a much larger role, which is some sort of congestion pricing or congestion management. But then even outside our city, the region has to really take forward a lot of these roles. And I'm looking over to Tom because he does a lot of that regional forum where these things, the parking policy, the congestion pricing policy, the road pricing policies, road dieting, you know, removing certain parts of the infrastructure, big sore topic. But those sort of things really have to come in concert, and we have to do it from a regional perspective.
What about changing how people bike? And I'd like to see maybe Andy address this. I know, like, in Idaho, they have different traffic laws for bikes versus cars. Is something like that realistic and feasible here?
Yeah, you know, it's asked all the time. My members ask me, when are we going to push for Idaho-style stop laws? And as you say, Steve, this is where if you're on a bike, you come to a stop sign, you treat it like a yield sign. If you come to a red light, you treat it like a stop sign. And the principle of this is yielding. And politically, it's very, very difficult to think about changing a law in California ever, but especially right now, and especially something that's as politically fraught as giving bicyclists some special favor. Bicyclists are not embraced as warmly throughout the rest of the state as they are in San Francisco. So the position that the Bike Coalition takes and an initiative that I'm really going to be pushing in the next 6 months or so is working with the police, working with other agencies, working with the membership to get the concept and enforce the concept of taking your turn, of having the police cite on failure to yield, not cite on stop sign violation. So that if you're riding your bike in the middle of the night in the Richmond and you roll through a stop sign, whatever, who cares? If you're riding your bike down Page Street at rush hour and you take a turn and you cut off some woman in a little Toyota and you scare the daylights out of her, I'll be there handing the cop a pen. I want to cite that. Don't take someone else's turn. We can have Idaho here in San Francisco, but it's going to take prioritizing the way that we enforce. It's a lot more effective. And in fact, I would say that the community of people riding bikes now needs to clean it up a little bit, just like we need the motorists to clean it up. That's, by the way, in the bike plan, mm-hmm. effective prioritization of enforcement. And we are thrilled to have a brand new chief of police. I've always been fond of Chief Fong, but we're thrilled to have a new chief who's coming from out of town, who doesn't have a lot of the relationships that would stop something like this. So the answer to this is we won't be pushing for an Idaho-style change in law. Instead, we're going to be pushing for a better way to prioritize enforcement. And it all starts with, don't you take my turn. I won't take your turn. Yeah. It's going to go a lot further.
And these kind of bike education efforts are spelled out in the bike plan. And they cut both ways. It's education for drivers and for cyclists, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, what is their relationship now like? How much education is needed there?
Well, I think everybody needs a lot of education because I would say if I said what I just said to a room full of bicyclists, and I think I might just have, how can you even think about citing a bicyclist? You know, there are 100 times more car mischief acts that we need to cite. Let's clean up the drivers first and then come bug me on my bike. And I say, I'm with you there because that's also part of the prioritization, mm-hmm. that you're stealing someone else's right-of-way is fairly benign compared to the guy in the SUV stealing that right-of-way.
Well, I'm sure the guy in the SUV listening at home is ready to come down here and get you to this
that.
Point.
Well, it's an issue, too, with moving transit vehicles through the city. I know, like on Church Street, they wanted to calm traffic. They had a lot of speeding traffic, so they put stop signs in Noe Valley on every block. And so if you ride the J Church, it takes forever because it's stopping. So, yeah, some of it is, you know, it's a really rights-conscious society and people want, you know, clear-cut, you know, I have the right to go, I don't have the right to go sort of enforcement. But I think Andy's onto something in that, you know, at some level it's you just want civility on the streets. You know, you need to pay attention. There's cyclists everywhere. There's pedestrians everywhere. There's transit vehicles everywhere. And there's cars everywhere in this city. How do we figure out how to manage these streets better? There's a lot of engineering solutions that are proposed, but those can be very complicated. They can not work. They can be confusing because if you treat every, you know, you have a different design of every intersection because some engineers dreamed it up, a lot of times you don't know what to do when you get there. Well, so,
we're going to see what our audience has to say about this.
Sure.
And just as a reminder to our audience, this mm-hmm. program is presented by the Commonwealth Club's InForum, and tonight mm-hmm. we're hosting San Francisco, the Wheel World. I'm Steve Jones, moderator for the evening, and in discussion with Tom Radulovich, the executive director of Livable City and a BART director, Andy Thornley, program director for the San Francisco Bike Coalition, and Tim Papandreou, assistant deputy director at the San Francisco Municipal Transportation Agency. I knew we'd get that. So let's go to the audience for questions. First.
I'm a little afraid to ask this question. Is the mic on? Mm-hmm. I'm a little afraid to ask this question. I think it's for Timothy.
Okay.
So there are 56 new bike projects that are going to come online, assuming that you get approval from the judge. How much are these going to cost the city, and is the funding secured in this horrible, horrific budget year?
Excellent question.
Good question. there is about 49 projects that are going through right now. About six of them are being hashed out as we speak. Once the injunction's lifted and all the things that happen with the appeals, et cetera, all that stuff taken care of, then we can start the implementation process of all those bike lanes. We have funding pretty much secured for the first 12 months of rolling out the bike program. It's about a three to four-year rollout. The first year is pretty much secure. The second year is about 50% secured, and the third year is about a third secured in terms of funding. And the reason why we say it's secured is that we have the existing grants that have been kind of sitting here as we've been wanting to use them. But we also know that once, now that we have a bicycle plan that's approved, we can actually start applying for certain funds that we weren't able to beforehand. Once the injunction's lifted as well, there will be even more funds that we can apply for. So we believe that during the grant process and the funding process, you're trying to get about 6 to 12 month lead time to get certain funds coming in the door. And that's what we've kind of felt like. The first 12 months of rollout, we're pretty okay. The second year, about 50-50, and then we'll get the rest of that for the second year. But the third year, we're going to really start to look at really aggressive funding sources out there to make sure we can fill those gaps.
And by that point, a couple of things will have happened. The regional transportation plan that was adopted a few months ago has committed a tenfold increase in funding for regional bike network. About two-thirds of our bike network here in the city is considered of regional importance and is eligible to get this money, $1 billion over the next 25 years. Also, by the time we start running out of money 2 years out, we will have a new federal transportation bill that's been approved, and it's going to be packed with bike money because, for crying out loud, we have the Speaker of the House representing us, so how can that go wrong? But so there are other sources that don't even exist yet or will be magnified. But to Tim's point, he thinks it's going to take 3 or 4 years. It'll go a lot faster.
To answer your question, it's about the projects are about $13 to $14 million. As we're refining them, we're noticing the price is coming down.
And it's actually not that much money to put in bike infrastructure the way we do it. I mean, compared to a mile of subway, compared to a mile of highway, we're really talking peanuts. If we put our mind to it as a city, we can find that money.
Absolutely.
It's one of the most cost-effective transportation investments we can make.
Move on to the next question.
Yes, one of the best things that Muni's done, as far as I'm concerned, is put those bike racks on the front of the bikes. Mm-hmm. And asking somebody to ride from the avenues downtown in the morning with a tailwind, no problem, but totally different situation, riding home in the evening with a 30-knot headwind. Mm-hmm. And I love it because I go from the downtown up to the top of Knob Hill, and then everything's downhill from there for a lot of it. But we're close to reaching the point where those two rack positions aren't going to do it. Are we looking at long-term at the bike trailers behind buses, say some buses or something
like
that?
What do you think, Tim? What's MTA working on with us?
Well, the double bike racks are very successful, and they're pretty successful all over the country. There are some other agencies that are using triple bike racks now, and that's something that we're definitely going to look at and start investigating very soon. The other thing as well, that I don't know about the bike trailers concept, but definitely something, the bike and the transit connection is really important. So we need to definitely look at that.
Bike racks bump on the steep hills, where you make a hard climb. A triple is just not going to work at all.
One thing a lot of transit agencies are doing, and Muni is starting to do with the buses, and I hope for our next generation of light rail cars will do, is do these low-floor vehicles. So if you eliminate the steps inside the car, it's actually a lot easier to get a bike into it. It's a lot easier for a person in a wheelchair or senior to get into that vehicle. So, with the low-floor streetcars or buses, there might be room inside the buses. Now, the fact is Muni's really crowded, but if we say, well, we're going to put more buses out there because, the bus plus bicycle is actually a lot cheaper than any other way of getting people to Muni, or actually, frankly, any other way of getting people downtown, we can do it. So I think looking at the car interiors and getting rid of these vehicles with steps inside might go some way towards creating more bike space inside.
And Tim, I believe you missed our discussion earlier about why can't we take folding bikes on some of these Muni trains? Why can't you take a folding bike on the NG?
Well, currently the injunction prohibits everything. So,
but going forward, how long do we can bring folding bikes on the NG?
In the bike plan, there is a pilot project outlined into looking at bikes on the rail system. So that pilot will start fairly shortly once we have the green light to go ahead on that. And then we'll look at all the different issues. But there's a lot of issues that we need to iron out. As Tom said, it's overcrowded. Mm-hmm. It'll self-regulate itself even without that rule. Why you can't take on folding bikes, I think that's something that we can definitely look at in the very near future. But allowing bicycles, full-size bicycles on the Muni system, until we get that space, it's going to be very difficult to convince the public, the riding public, that that's actually something we need to move forward on.
Next question.
Well, more of a couple of statements here. First of all, I'd like to thank Andy and the San Francisco Bike Coalition for everything they have done for the cyclist community in San Francisco. Second point is that there was a lot of conversation about the 20 to 30-year-olds or whatever. Well, I'm a 47-year-old cyclist, and I've been doing it for 20-plus years. The last point I want to make is that it seems the discussion is always us against them, the cyclists against the drivers. And I think what's being forgotten is that a lot of us, me particularly, have choices. And I do have a minivan. And today I decided to drive rather than cycle, and I could have probably been here as quickly. But what prevented me from doing it is the lack of infrastructure, whether or not there's going to be parking. And had I known for sure that there's going to be parking, I would have rode here. So that's basically what I want to say.
Andy, that's probably good for you. How are we going to expand bike parking? I know the Bike Coalition's got a valet parking program. What else are we going to see?
Right. No, and it's a huge issue because when we talk about the bike network, a lot of people think stripes on the street or better than that, but the network is also both ends of that, and it's a real chilling effect. As our speaker just said, you know, if you don't know that there's a safe place to put your bike at the other end, especially biking to work. Mm-hmm. So not only will we see hundreds of new U-racks come out on the sidewalks, but you're going to see more secure parking in various places. And one particular initiative, there is planning code that's coming forward. The San Francisco Planning Code is already very strong to oblige parking in commercial buildings and residential. But there is a
new buildings, unfortunately.
Yeah. There is no retroactivity. But there is the notion of just being permitted to bring your bike into a building. Right. Many buildings permit this now, and you may work in a building, live in a building, where you can just wheel your bike in, take it on the elevator. That's very powerful. And New York City has been flirting with the idea of making that obligatory. If you own or manage a building, you can't turn a cyclist away. You have to let the bike in, you know, take it up to your office. Now, there is some reasonable limit to that, but I think one of the most powerful ideas is just that, not building anything new, but obliging building managers and owners to let you in with your darn bike and bring it upstairs. And we will be pushing for that while being reasonable. We won't be absolute about it, but
yeah,
I think that's where
we know about you bike nuts. Okay, next question.
Hi, I'm a pedestrian, a Muni user, and I have a car, which I mostly drive on the weekends. Mm-hmm. But now my question is, how are rules enforced in the biking community? I know, and I have a car, I have a driver's license that can be taken away from me. I can go to court, be sent to court, mm-hmm. to have action taken against me, and I can be sued. Mm-hmm. So I don't understand how it works.
It's a good question, Tom. I mean, talk a little bit about how bikes self-regulate one another, whether it's critical mass or in the streets every day.
Right. Well, I mean, you know, if you're a cyclist and you do something illegal, you can get a ticket. So there is enforcement of the vehicle code. If you break the law, then you can you're entitled to get a ticket. You know, you don't need a license to cycle, so they can't take your cycle away from you. But there is enforcement at that level. You know, I was thinking as we were talking about bike rules, New York City got rid of the rule for, you know, they don't have hours of operation for bikes on subways. It's use your judgment. Mm-hmm. And, you know, but they're New Yorkers, right? If you try and get on a crowded train, they'll say, you idiot, what are you doing? You know,
that's the enforcement.
That's the enforcement. There's actually a social level of enforcement. And I would say that, you know, again, it's just about sharing space and using common sense. And, you know, where that doesn't prevail, people get really ruly. But, you know, if we could have a situation where common sense prevailed, I think we could do with less rules and more common sense. So, you know, for me, it's about courtesy. It's like, yeah, even if I have my bike on BART and it's not the time, or it's the time when bikes are allowed, if that train's too crowded, I don't try and get on it. And that's just what we need more of.
Well, and I will start to, I think mm-hmm. the question, I get asked this question mm-hmm. a lot, that if, you know, when will we license mm-hmm. bicyclists? Somebody just ran me down on the sidewalk and he just rode off. And if that was a car, mm-hmm. I'd say, oh, that's California XYZ, blah, blah, blah. I got the license plate on that. Isn't there anything you can do with bikes? Tim, what are you doing about that?
My response is that a bicyclist is a vehicle under the California Vehicle Code, and they have all the rules and responsibilities of a vehicle. So it's up to the enforcing agency to enforce those laws.
So
but they are required by the California Vehicle Code to act like a vehicle.
And what I would say in talking to the police, one of the big issues is not only are the police not ticketing cyclists, rampant unenforcement of bike infractions, they're not ticketing motorists, they're not ticketing muni drivers, they're not ticketing SamTrans bus drivers, they're not ticketing anybody.
They're also not solving a lot of homicides.
And they're not solving homicides.
Next
so
question.
We need a coherent raising up of all of that.
Next question.
So I really appreciate this dialogue. Mm-hmm. I think that we can all agree that with differences, it's a very group of like-minded people, by and large, and what I keep hearing over and over again is the word access. And I really find that fascinating, because when I have a dialogue with people some other times, it's not about access, it's about, as you guys said, you cyclists.
Right.
And it's really different, it's really interesting, and it's really about taking the streets versus giving access, I think is a huge difference. And
you got a question?
Sorry. So living in the Mission, I see a whole demographic that isn't the 25-year-old kamikaze, but is the often Latino migrant worker, mm-hmm. and they are on the busiest streets. Mm-hmm. They are on the El Caminos on the peninsula, and I really I want to hear what we're doing to voice this often not in the political realm, you know, attending a forum like this person.
Yeah, Tim, I mean, are there certain streets that the bike shouldn't be on? I mean, how do
Well, I mean, there's, you know, everyone should exercise their judgment on where they should and shouldn't ride. Obviously, there's safer. I mean, all the streets, in our opinion, are safe. We think that people should exercise their judgment. But being, I'm originally worked in Los Angeles, and we looked at the exact community you were talking about, the service workers who work at night. They've come from usually Mexico and Central America. And they're not as aware of the rules and regulations that we have especially in California. So more targeted outreach, specific outreach on how to ride on the way that in the prevailing traffic direction, helmets, bicycle lights, et cetera, all that sort of stuff. It's just more about education, a lot more education, more targeted education to mm-hmm. the specific groups that are the most vulnerable and the least politically savvy. And, you know, even with the Bicycle Coalition, they probably can't afford to be even members of the Bicycle Coalition. So that's where, I mean, Andy and I have talked about this before, about how do we reach out to these specific groups of people who are not being represented.
I'm going to try to slide in one last quick question. So quick question, quick answer.
Yeah. Thank you guys for all the advocacy you guys are doing for bike riders and cyclists. We talked a little bit about law enforcement today, and one major topic that has yet to be brought up is actually bike security in terms of theft. We know that SFPD is already overburdened with a lot of other things, including murders. But bikes are very important to bike owners, and when they are stolen, they are not actually, and there's no investigations. They're not followed up on, and there's a whole black market with bike security issues and with the black market with people trading bikes and selling bikes. What do we do? Right. I think there's solutions
GPS
out there
them.
With technology,
yeah,
but how do we get
GPS
people to do
them.
It?
Yeah. Two fast answers to that. The standard answer is more, better, secure parking. So if you've got somebody watching your bike, you brought it up here, it was leaning in the back of the room, that's actually the most practical thing. Seems like a lot of work, but the Bike Coalition, we've been mostly focused because of what you said. The police are just over their heads. But with a new chief coming in, this is another thing we'll be bringing. And as Tim's saying, GPS and sting work. This is a place, I don't believe in pedestrian crosswalk stings very much, but I do believe that if we can work with the police, MTA, Bike Coalition, and other interests, and get a couple of $2,000 bikes out there and follow them upstream to the truck that's taking them to Nevada, because that's not happening now. I think that would be very powerful.
Yeah.
So,
are there things people can do if they see sketchy stuff in the street or what looks like a bike fencing operation or anything?
Yeah,
like that?
I mean, they can, but do they? I mean, that's the thing. You know, you see someone break into a car, you say, hey, you're breaking into a car. I mean, I'm not sure. People kind of have this, I don't know, it's just we really need to be a lot more. There's a lot of things out there that include bike theft that we should really be looking out for each other, but the question is, do we?
We just had an ice cream ride a couple of Sundays ago of 150 people out riding around right here, 5th Street at Market. Saw a guy with bolt cutters cutting a cable lock, confronted the guy. The guy shrugs. He's doing this right in front of 150 bicyclists and ended up giving chase to the guy. He disappeared in the weeds, but they were able to save the two bikes. But to what Tim is saying, in a city you can have these awful things happening right in witness of humanity, and they continue on. So part of it is
let's just turn up their iPod and put the sunglasses on.
So we're all gonna band together with this. But for now, what we're gonna do is we're gonna give our audience, our panelists, a big hand for their thoughts here tonight. And now this medium of Inform and the Commonwealth Club is adjourned.